Is that on? Good. So I'm calling these talks Mathematical Aspects of String Duality. And since Dan mentioned it this morning, let me just remind those who don't know, or tell those who don't know, remind everybody else, that the notes from the IIS program last year can be found at http://www.math.iis.edu/tildedrm, that's me, /QFT. In particular, you will find there some very nice notes of Eric Doker, almost complete. I think we're just missing the last lecture now, which really treats perturbative string theory, well, building on a course that we had in the first term from Christoph Gavitsky on conformal field theory. And he develops in those notes, in terms that I think, having lived through the lectures myself, in terms that I think mathematicians can really relate to, a lot of the basics of perturbative string theory, including stuff that all sort of start by assuming here. So if you're not familiar with perturbative string theory, that's a place where you might try to bone up on it. So I'm going to focus on a few particular aspects of string duality at the exclusion of some things which I think most physicists would find natural to include. So what I'm interested in is really geometric aspects, not just mathematical aspects. And I'm interested in two kinds of issues. I'm interested in how do interesting geometries in space-time arise? And I'm also interested in the question of what is the geometry of the moduli space or parameter space, let me just say, of the parameter space, spaces of these string theories. So superstring theories naturally live in 10 dimensions. 9 plus 1 space-time dimensions. But one can always choose to study, although the theory is usually formulated assuming that the ambient space-time is a flat space, say Minkowski space, one can always attempt to study these string theories on more complicated manifolds. So we would like to study these theories on space-times x with an action of a Poincaré group not simply in 9 plus 1 dimensions, but in d plus 1 dimensions. So I'll write that as p1 plus d in d plus 1 dimensions. So I'd like to assume that there's an action of the Poincaré group p plus 1, of dimension p plus 1, excuse me, from d plus 1 dimensions on my spacetime x, such that, well, so in particular, this action includes translations, and I can think about modding out by the action, which ought to produce something of somewhat smaller dimension. So it's not an effective action, but the quotient still makes sense, such that this quotient space is well, compact, or in a maybe slightly different version of the story, at least finite volume with boundaries of some type specified in advance. So we'll see that we're naturally led to consider cases where X mod P 1D is not quite compact. And then you can hope that if the size, if the, in fact, 9 minus D volume of this remaining space is small, the resulting theory can be approximately described, at least, by, say, a field theory in D plus 1 dimensions. And in fact, the approximation should be good enough that you could expect to get better and better versions of the approximation, computing better, more and more correction terms, if you fully understood what string theory was like on this spacetime X. And the parameters in the corrections would involve, for example, the volume or other of the, well, basically the volume of this compact space. Now, I've kind of written it in the most general form that's reasonable. Most of the time, that's not a good choice. So, usually we take X to be of the form Minkowski space cross Y, and then, of course, this X mod P1D is just Y. That's our compact space. A slight variant of this, which I will discuss some examples of at the very end of this lecture series, if it ever gets to the very end, would be to take a topological product, M1D cross Y, so topologically, but with a so-called warped product metric. In which the metric on the Minkowski space, which, since I want it to be invariant under Poincaré, is uniquely determined by that up to a scale factor. So some scale factor on the metric in Minkowski space is allowed to depend on Y. That would be a warping factor on such a metric. So I don't think, correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think anybody's made a very systematic study of other possibilities of really non-trivially varying spaces which don't necessarily split as a topological product. I don't know if you can learn anything interesting by doing that or not. Pardon? Well, I could make some kind of bundle of Minkowski spaces, which was non-trivial topologically, right? And yeah, I just don't know what happens if I do that. Yeah, maybe P1D wouldn't act. Yeah. Well, see, but it can act. I mean, because it's got translations, right? It could sort of be an affine bundle. I don't think I have why. It would fiber over Y. Be an affine bundle over Y. I don't know if I have a Y section. Okay, well, this is not the moment to solve this problem, but anyway, these are the two cases that I'll consider. Now, we're actually interested in a more restrictive situation than this, and I was hoping that Dan would say a few things that he didn't say this morning, but he will say them later, but I'll say them in some form now. So we're actually interested in preserving some, but not all, of the supersymmetry which the string theory that we're studying, or possibly the M theory, oh, I should have said, I said I'm going to study theories on spacetimes with an action of a Poincaré group. Superstring theories live in 9 plus 1 dimensions. There's also a cousin of them called M theory, which people, the faithful attendees of the IIS seminar, have not heard too much about yet, and I'll come to that a little bit later today, which lives in 10 plus 1 dimensions. So this discussion could apply to either of those situations. We want to preserve some, but not all, of the supersymmetry which string theory or M theory has in 10 or 11 dimensions. And, so these are supergravity theories at low energy, at least. And the way that they look as supergravity theories is that they're, if I look at the Poincaré algebra, just to make my life a little bit simpler, this lives as the even part of a superalgebra. And the odd part consists of some number of copies of the Skinner representation. So what you want to do is take some of the supersymmetries. In 9 plus 1 or 10 plus 1 dimensions. And you want to decompose the corresponding spinner. Well, just for definiteness, let me work in 9 plus 1 dimensions. So if I take SO19 and split it up as SO1D plus SO9 minus D, then I can try to decompose the spinner representation from this space as sum of representations over here. And I would like to preserve, well, I will expect to find a spinner representation happening in D plus 1 dimensions, which will give me a possible supersymmetry generator to extend the Poincaré algebra in D plus 1 dimensions. I'm keeping the translations, for example, and the rotations in D plus 1 dimensions as well. But because this typically will be a much larger representation than this one, I'll try to find conditions under which I get to keep only a part of that supersymmetry representation. So just as an example of how this might work, if you take the spinner representation for SO19, which is a 16-dimensional representation, I'll follow the usual physicist convention by labeling a representation by its dimension when there's no danger of confusion. Pardon? All right. That's a good point. If I try to decompose this under SO15 plus SO4, say, just to take a concrete example, well, let me rewrite SO4 as SU2 plus SU2, just so that I can label the representations better. And then this turns out to be a spinner representation here plus the same spinner 1, 2. It's the opposite spinner, isn't it? Plus the opposite spinner 1, 2. What could I do to preserve at least part of this spinner if I'm studying this kind of representation? Well, if I'd like to preserve this one, then I should insist that this first SU2 should be preserved, say, by the holonomy group, by any holonomy transformations which I could make. This is just to get a reasonable theory when I'm looking at the metric on the space, the part of the space-time that's going to live in this direction. And this gives me a reduction, a natural reduction of the holonomic condition, whereas I would have expected to allow for a general four-manifold in that base direction. I would have expected a holonomy of SO4. This motivates a reduction of holonomy down to SU2, so that I should, if I want to preserve supersymmetry, I should insist on a particular holonomy group. So that's... let's see. I want... so I had some... did I get it backwards? That's right. Yeah. So, so if I make the, if well, because we didn't hear too much about supergravity theories today, so what sort of, what happens when you have one of these, spinorial transformations? Well, what happens is that it's like the square root of a usual translation, right? And so you want to make sure that you want to make sure that any translations and rotations that you do in the remaining space, which will involve all of this SO15 together with whatever holonomy you get from SO4, preserves this, this that we're discussing. So I guess I'm going to allow I guess the holonomy should be contained in the second SU2. And then I have a chance that this this component will still preserve whatever theory it is that I'm building. So that's the beginning of an answer to a question such as how do interesting geometries in space-time arise. It won't be until we're able to say something about supersymmetry in some detail that we'll see restrictions on the geometries. The other thing which I want to discuss, as I say, is, and I should say this first part has really very little to do with string duality itself. It's an older story. The thing which I want to focus on is what is the geometry of the parameter spaces of these string theories, particularly string theories formulated on spaces such as these, where what we're doing is trying to preserve not only a lower dimensional Poincaré invariance, but in fact some lower dimensional supersymmetry or supergravity algebra acting on the theory, and where we're, as a result, restricting the possible fibers Y in those, excuse me, bases Y in those maps X to Y with fibers M1D. Okay, so what are the known string theories? So another purpose, at least of today's lecture, is to kind of set out a scorecard for people who aren't intimately familiar with all these things. So there are five known superstring theories. And they have various names. So there's the one called type 1. And I'll just remind you a few things about it. So it involves both open and closed strings. And the supersymmetry algebra, I'm going to label supersymmetry algebras by the number of supersymmetry generators or supercharges. So it has 16 supercharges. It involves Yang-Mills theory with gauge group spin 32 mod Z2. Then we have type 2A and 2B. These are closed strings only. 32 supercharges. There turn out to be two possible algebras with 32 supercharges in 10 dimensions. And so one of them is associated to one and one is associated to the other. In fact, the names come from a classification of possible supergravity theories in 10 dimensions, which precedes string theory. And then we have the heterotic theories. I'll use the notation HE and HO for these theories. So these are the so-called heterotic string theories. They're a little strange to describe because of the different behavior in the left and right moving sectors when they're formulated as perturbative string theories. I'll just point out that they have 16 supercharges. And there's an associated Yang-Mills sector with a gauge group of type E8 cross E8 for HE and type spin 32 mod Z2 for HO. The algebra is, of course, SO32. And if you're watching algebras more than groups, people have a tendency to refer to this by the name SO32, and that's where the O and HO comes from. So these are the players, and as I mentioned before, there's also M theory in 11 dimensions. It's an as yet unknown theory, quantum theory, which at low energies behaves as 11-dimensional supergravity. And 11-dimensional supergravity has 32 supercharges. So these statements about the number of supersymmetries refer, again, to the situation of a flat spacetime. You can at least expect to see the algebra acting, the corresponding supersymmetry algebra acting in a nice way on, or at least a good part of that algebra to act in a nice way on, say, the tangent spaces to spacetime at various points. That's a structure which should remain, and that's kind of underlies the ability to analyze what's going on when you look at these more complicated spacetimes that are not homogeneous in all directions. Now, so the fact that there are only five superstring theories, together with this fixed guy called M theory, is very appealing. You start with a basic idea that you might model the universe using strings. You do a lot of work, and after doing a lot of this work, you discover that there really were not too many ways that you might carry that process out, and there are some distinct signatures in 10 and 11 dimensions for those different theories. They're all sort of distinguished by these properties that I'm mentioning here. On the other hand, there are connections between these theories, connections among these theories. And these are, generally speaking, known as dualities. Now, the use of the word duality and string duality is a little loose sometimes. So the basic problems whose solutions sort of fall under the rubric of duality look like this. So you can ask the following questions. You can ask, first of all, are two string theories, say, one formulated on space-time X and the other formulated on spacetime X prime, equivalent in some natural sense? So that's one sort of thing that might come out of a duality analysis. Or is it possible that, the same string theory, but looked at on X or on X prime, is equivalent. It's equivalent theory formulated on X is equivalent to the theory formulated on X prime. And now by X, I should think of the geometry of X as including all the data needed to specify the model of string theory. So I'll review in a couple of minutes for these various string theories what sort of data that is. And what I mean here is that I take two different, what appear to be different sets of data, and ask whether it's possible that I get the same string theory using those two different sets of data. So that would be what you might think of as an unexpected equivalence relation among what you thought were the inputs that described the parameters in the string theory, particularly in the I've been trying to avoid the word compactification of string theory, but I'm not going to be able to. So this is called I've erased it, but this this strategy of taking X to be of this form, or possibly of this form, or maybe the more general bundle construction that I gave is called compactifying the string theory. It's really a partial compactification at best, and if I let Y be non-compact, as I will in some instances, then it's not even a partial compactification. But anyway, that's called string compactification. So I have to make the following comment. Perturbative string theory is in pretty reasonable shape as a theory. It's been worked out in a lot of detail, sort of from been studied long enough that people, even though it's only has this perturbative formulation, people have a pretty clear idea of exactly what it consists of, even if they're missing the non-perturbative ultimate formulation of it. When we start to include non-perturbative effects, which is what all the modern work about dualities is about, we're on much less firm ground at the moment. So I think it's fair to say that most of the equivalences that are believed in the physics literature have a certain amount of evidence amassed in their favor. And the working definition is, well, you start out with one piece of evidence, and you ask yourself, could I possibly get another piece of evidence that would support this? And you make a check that wasn't known before you started, and it succeeds. And then, at least temporarily, you believe it, and so does everybody else who reads HEP-TH the next morning. Now, yeah, it's right. So, pardon? Equivalence of low-energy effective actions. Right, so. That's right. So one could try to check S matrices, for example, but for almost all of these equivalences, that's way too much to ask at the moment if you really want it checked. So
you mean S matrices on the M1D factor for different Y and Y prime?
Exactly. Moduli spaces of vacua. I'm also trying to use the word parameter space instead of moduli space for a particular reason, and that is that moduli space in quantum field theories means something very specific, which often coincides with parameter space, but not always. And so I want to make it clear that even though a geometer would often use the term moduli space in these contexts, I'm not necessarily discussing the moduli spaces as they occur in quantum field theory. But that's more a distinction for the benefit of the physicists here than for the mathematicians. So whether they're the same string theory or different string theories in some sense doesn't matter too much, but it will affect the interpretation, because here the interpretation will be, well, if I'm going to study string theory of the first type on spaces of a certain kind X, or I might as well have studied string theories of the second type on spaces of the kind X prime. Whereas here, I'm actually taking a parameter space, which I thought I understood for one particular set of string theories, and then discovering that there's another equivalence relation that has to be imposed to get a true parameter space for these theories. Now, it's very hard at the moment to say that two theories are inequivalent. It's more difficult to say that they're inequivalent than to say that they're equivalent. So that shows a little bit about the state of the art in some sense. a more general question, which also gets asked in the same breath, and which doesn't necessarily have answers of the kind referred to here, is this: describe all possible boundary or limit points of the parameter space, say, for a fixed type of string theory and a fixed class of X's. Now, some of these boundary or limit points are going to be places where we can do something that looks like a perturbative expansion of a string theory. So one of the parameters in all of these string theories is the expectation value of the dilaton field. And that's supposed to be the expansion parameter for the perturbative analysis. So the way to interpret the boundary point of sending that expansion parameter to zero is that's the limit, the limiting place in the parameter space where we believe we understand a fair amount about the theory by the usual analysis using conformal field theory and looking at the studying string theory in the pre-revolutionary way. These parameters that I'm speaking of should be dimensionless. That's right. There's also a scale in these problems, and when you're actually looking at sizes of things, you should put in the appropriate power of the scale. But yes, we want dimensionless parameters. So M theory has no parameters. M theory in 11 dimensions, by which I mean on a space-time of the form M110, has no parameters. It has a scale but has no parameters. So there's nothing interesting to say in terms of parameter spaces for M theory, for pure M theory. If I look at the pure string theories, so maybe I should have said in flat 11 dimensions. If I look at the pure string theories in flat 10 dimensions, well, they get their parameters from scalar fields. So it turns out that 2B has two parameters. The dilaton and the Ramon-Ramon scalar. The Ramon-Ramon scalar is periodic, so there's a natural way of collecting these into the dilaton should be positive and this should be periodic, so there's a natural way into collecting these into a parameter which varies in the upper half plane. The 2A and type 1 and heterotic theories all have one parameter in 10 dimensions, just the dilaton. So although this is historically not the first thing that was done, one of the dualities which is believed to hold, conjectured to hold, is the S-duality of type 2B theory, which asserts that the true parameter space of 2B in flat 10 dimensions, or on M19, is actually H mod SL2Z. Sorry, this should have been H mod Z, is the way I wanted to write it, thinking of it as half of the cylinder. And that Z, the periodic, the periodicity of the Ramon-Ramon scalar, is enhanced by a so-called S-duality transformation to an action of SL2Z on the upper half plane. So that eliminates one of the questions that we might have asked, which was, well, what would you get if you went to the other end of the 2B moduli space? There is no other end of the 2B moduli space. This S-duality transformation takes what you might have thought before knowing about that transformation as two possible boundaries. It identifies the two possible boundaries and tells you that there really is only one limit point to look at in that particular space. We still can ask, however, what happens at the two different ends of the one real number, which is serving as a parameter for these 2A, 1, HE, and HO theories. Pardon? That's not so well known. I think some very interesting things happen there, and I don't think that's too well known at the moment. Well, when I talk about F-theory, I'll come to this again, because in F-theory, where we allow the dilettante to vary in 2B, some very interesting things do happen at those particular points. So, still working in 10 dimensions, there's another S-duality, which people call S-dualities. I can't explain the origin of the letters. We'll have S, T's, and U's. Maybe somebody will explain the origin of the letters from the audience. Well, the T-duality is the old one, right? T-duality is perturbative. And T is for torus?
In all traditions of FPU.
No, that I understand. I understand. I understand. So, but the S, okay. S is Montanan Olive, yeah? Isn't the S because of the generators of SL2Z, one of which is called S?
I don't think so.
S and T?
It may affect. Well, there's also the S field, the complex field also relates to the S. I think actually it might have come from there.
I see. It's not the S channel or anything. That I know. Right, so the dilettante, as I said, measures the expansion parameter for the perturbative analysis, and that's called a weak coupling expansion. Going to the other end of the moduli space is said to be going to strong coupling. So the strong coupling limit, this S-duality says, of the type 1 theory is the HO theory, and vice versa. Now, you have to do some rescalings of fields when you do that. You have to be careful in comparing. I haven't really told you what the field content is of these theories, but you have to be careful in comparing the theories. But the basic behavior in the parameters, matching up the parameter space, is that going to one end of this one parameter space, going to this limit point, you see the type 1 theory, and if you go to the other end point, you see the heterotic theory with the same Yang-Mills gauge group. So that leaves two more. So the strong coupling limit of type 2A and the strong coupling limit of HE. And the duality equivalence, which is believed to hold for these, is that the 2A theory on M19 should be equivalent with a particular mapping of parameters to M theory on M19 across the circle. And the heterotic theory with E8 cross E8 gauge group in flat space should be equivalent to M theory on M19 cross S1 mod Z2. So this mod Z2 is going to require some comment. The Z2 quotient of M theory requires care, but the basic picture is that, well, there were two fixed points of the action of Z2 on S1, and so just geometrically, when you mod out, you get an interval with some boundaries, and then through a Chan-Payton construction with respect to those boundaries, quite similar to what Greg Moore was talking about in the previous lecture, you end up with an E8 gauge symmetry associated with each of those boundaries. So that's kind of the origin in this picture from the E8. So I mentioned that in 11 dimensions there's no parameter to M theory, but if I formulate M theory on a space like this, then the size of the circle is the natural parameter that's being looked at. And in this case, the strong coupling limit of 2A, the S1 is getting large. And in this case, the strong coupling limit of HE, the S1 mod Z2, is actually getting small. So these two, these are called end of the world nine brains. They're 9 plus 1 dimensional spaces which are forming the boundaries. And these two boundaries are coming together, and you end up with an effective 10 dimensional theory. I said that backwards. Strong coupling limit goes to infinity, yeah? Right. Weak coupling is coming to zero, right. So what sort of evidence is produced for these equivalences? Well, one view is that this is a definition of M theory, or one of these at least is a definition of M theory. And then you need a conjecture that says that you get the same thing doing these two different limits of these spaces. The reason for believing that there is an 11-dimensional theory that behaves this way has to do with the behavior of D0 brains, 0 plus 1 dimensional D brains of the sort that Greg was discussing earlier. And by making calculations with the spectrum of those D0 brains, you get something which is very reminiscent of what you would expect to find if there were an 11-dimensional quantum theory which had been formulated on a space like this. In particular, you see the remnants of things which are wrapping around the S1 showing up as behaving exactly the same way as the spectrum of these D0 brains as you push the string coupling from the 2A perspective to be larger and larger, going to stronger and stronger coupling. Okay, so that, oh, and also let me just point out while it's here, here I have 32 supercharges in this statement. In this case, I have 16 supercharges for both of those theories. Here, the strong coupling limit of 2A was again a case of 32 supercharges, and this strong coupling limit of HE was a case of 16 supercharges. Remember that there were, I mentioned in 10 dimensions, two different kinds of algebras with 32 supercharges, and they're showing up separately here. But at the moment, I've got, in 10 dimensions, two different things happening with 16 supercharges, although the algebra, the supersymmetry algebra that underlies them is the same one. This is the first instance of the phenomenon I mentioned where you might be working on a spacetime that isn't exactly compact, and where you need to have said something about the boundaries that are going to be allowed. Pardon? Strong. Everything that's written here is strong, not string.
Oh, so strong.
Right. So the weak coupling was the when the ex- I have a little trouble because there's a funny, very funny sign convention in the physics literature. But weak coupling is where the expansion parameter is small, and strong coupling is where the expansion parameter is large. So the perturbative formulation of string theory really only picks out the coefficients in some kind of expansion that happens near the weak coupling value. And that's the part that's quite well understood by studying maps from world sheets into space-times and things of that sort. Now we're trying to sort of leapfrog over the difficulties involved in making a definition that goes beyond that and learn something about the answer and try to figure out what happens if you were to push that coupling not only well beyond any place where the thing might have converged, but all the way to the other side of the moduli space.
For two things to be equal, they have to be of the same kind of object, but in one space to another, which one has to space to same, doesn't that?
That's right. Even making complete sense of the state spaces is something which hasn't been done, even before we talk about S matrices. So I think it's fair to say that people are testing consequences of a proposed duality or equivalence rather than directly testing the duality or equivalence. And they're getting clues about the existence of the duality by noticing things like a spectrum of particles that looks very much like it was the limit from some continuous spectrum that got, you know, when you wrap this on S1, but with the S1 very large, then the quantization condition is very weak, and you sort of get this continuum limit in the end. Other questions? Okay, so that's the story in 11 dimensions and 10 dimensions, and I'll proceed down to 9 dimensions. So 8 plus 1 dimensions. That's what I mean is that I'm looking for cases where the Poincaré group in 8 plus, or 1 plus 8, I guess was my convention, 1 plus 8 dimensions is still acting. And I'm still going to focus my attention, in fact, I'm not going to get away from that today, on the cases with 32 supercharges and 16 supercharges, and only look for models with that high amount of supersymmetry. Now, as you can imagine, the further down in dimension we go, the more reducible the spinner representation from 11 or 10 dimensions will become. And for that reason, there's a chance of breaking more and more of the supersymmetry by appropriately choosing a structure for the part of the space whose translational invariance I'm not retaining. So that, in fact, once I get down to 8 dimensions, I'll start to introduce other models of that kind where we can get down to 8 supercharges in some natural way instead of 32 or 16. But at the moment, I'll stick with 32 and 16. Of course, you could put in an arbitrary transverse space and break all the supersymmetry, but then we would have a non-supersymmetric theory and we'd have a lot harder time saying what was going on. We want to study these 10-dimensional theories and also the 11-dimensional string theory by compactifying on another S1, and that leads pretty quickly to something called T-duality, which is already a property of the perturbative string theory and was studied extensively some 10, 12 years ago. So the basic idea of T-duality is to consider, I'll just start with the easy case of considering string theory, say, formulated on a space of the form S1 cross Z. where Z is probably a flat space, but anyway, I'm mainly focusing on what happens with respect to this S1. So you can do two things. The string can wrap around the S1 some number of times. Let me call it W times. And you can also take the states. State space has Fourier expansions around the S1. And maybe if the size of the string is, so length of S1 is R. Again, I'm completely ignoring the 2 pi factors, which I didn't bother to work out. These could be labeled by a momentum, which looks like N over R. So there's some integer N, some integer W measuring the winding, and some integer N measuring the momentum in the quantization around S1, the Fourier expansion of functions on the circle. So now there's a formula which says that the mass of a string state essentially behaves like N over R plus W times R. Well, I'm slightly lying, but that's the essential feature of the formula. So if we take the limit R goes to infinity, then what happens? Well, if R goes to infinity, then the W not equal zero states become infinitely massive. In a quantum theory, a massive state can be treated in many respects as a perturbation of the theory without the massive state. You can do something called integrating out the massive states. And the error that you make in doing that integrating out process depends on the mass in such a way that the heavier the particle gets, the more massive it gets, the less it affects the theory where you've integrated it out. So in the limit, you should be able to ignore states that are becoming infinitely massive. And the leftover states, well, these N over R values approach a continuum. That's the signal of decompactification, a signal of this S1 opening back up into a free direction. The radius has gotten very large, and it's just some direction with no periodicity imposed whatsoever, which is what you would have expected, a continuum of possible momentum values if you hadn't imposed a periodicity. That's the same feature of the spectrum that I alluded to here in discussing the strong coupling limit of 2a, where by studying the spectrum, not of string states in that case, but of these Dirichlet zero brains, these d brains in 0 plus 1 dimensions, you found a similar sort of pattern in the limit, which was an indication that there was another dimension geometrically opening up. Now, that R goes to infinity limit would be seen to have the same properties in either a field-theoretic or a string-theoretic treatment. In a field-theoretic treatment, you wouldn't have the option of winding the string around more than once. But in string theory, we see that something interesting happens even when R goes to zero. So if R goes to zero, then, let's see, then the N not equal zero states become infinitely massive and can be integrated out. And the states of the form WR approach a continuum. So this suggests a duality which happens even at weak coupling. So a weak coupling duality, which is why it can be discussed in perturbation theory, between one string theory at radius r and another one at radius 1 over r, well, there's some units that have to be put in, where momentum and winding modes are exchanged. Momentum winding here is supposed to go over to winding momentum over there. Now, if you look more carefully about how this argument fits in to the actual five string theories that we have, you discover that the 2A string theory, formulated on spaces of the form M1A cross S1, is equivalent with these conditions about R going to 1 over R to the 2B theory on M1A cross, and let me call it S1 prime, just so that we're clear that the radii have to map appropriately. The heterotic theory with E8 cross E8 gauge symmetry is equivalent to the heterotic theory with spin 32 mod Z2 symmetry. And the type 1 theory on M1A cross S1 goes to a sort of strange thing. I guess the 1A, 1B never really caught on, did it? I mean, it's really a shame. But something called 1 prime, which is really formulated here on M1A cross S1 mod Z2. I agree it should be. Yeah, well, so just because I'm trying, among other things, to explain to people, to the mathematicians, what they're seeing when they look at the physics literature, this is sometimes called, 1 is sometimes called 1B, so that 1 prime can be called 1A. And make a more of a symmetry between these two things. And there's some sense in which this is this duality has a Z2 quotient, which is this duality in some important sense. I need to tell you what 1 prime means. I haven't told you that yet. So remember that the 2A theory, has closed strings only. But if we introduce 2A with, this boundary at S1 mod Z2, it's something which is called an orientifold hyperplane. I love the etymology of the word orientifold. So first of all, there's the word orbifold, which was invented by Bill Thurston or maybe some committee of his students in these lectures that he gave in 78, 79 in Princeton. And then orbifold got slightly modified in this context to orientifold because you're taking not just a quotient by a Z2 action in the usual way, where the Z2 is acting only on the space-time, in some sense, but you're also reversing the orientation of the world sheet at the same moment as you take the quotient. So it's some strange action of Z2 on the entire theory, not just on the space-time. So you've got these boundaries of S1 mod Z2, and you also might have some 8 plus 1 dimensional D-brains. In this notation, they're called D8 brains. And as such, you can have open strings which end on these things. So if I allow a slightly unusual version of 2A with open strings included and with this boundary and with these additional D8 brains, and in fact, there have to be exactly 16 D8 brains in this theory. Then I get this thing, which is called 1 prime, formulated on space-time to the form space-time of the form M1A cross S1 mod V2. So this is what an analysis of the R goes to zero limit of the compactified type 1 theory leads to. The reason that you start to get strange objects like this has to do with this argument that we gave about winding modes and momentum modes, which I've erased, unfortunately, where with open strings, there aren't any possibilities of winding modes. So that argument about opening up an extra dimension from the point of view of the open strings breaks down. So the open strings do not live on a larger dimensional space when you go to this limit, whereas the closed strings do live on this larger dimensional space. And the interpretation of that is that the endpoints of the open strings are confined to the boundary of the space, which is of codimension 1. No, there's a scale. There's a self-dual, so-called self-dual radius, where they're both of the same size, but which is order one in whatever the units are. That sort of sets the size of the units, if you like. But yeah, you have to put in a unit. I mean, you have to put in a unit of area divided by R if you want them both to be measured in length. Right? Yeah. Well, that's true. I I copied this argument from you. We're starting in type 1 without any boundary conditions. And we're asking what happens when you T-dualize. Right. So we only have Neumann boundaries. And so I don't think there's any winding because nothing's tied down, right? I think you only get winding modes if you actually have things attached to D brains. So Joe's argument was that with no fixed ends to the strings, to the open strings, you don't get these winding modes when you T-dualize type 1. T-dualizing type 1 prime and trying to go back, that's a more complicated story. Okay, so this is part of the story, but I didn't have to include the discussion about the dilaton, which was measuring how strongly coupled the string perturbation expansion was, at all in this story, because it was, you know, this sort of old-fashioned version where you didn't do anything non-perturbative. You just did it in a good, more or less rigorous way. If we include the if we include the analysis of the dilaton, well, now we have to look at two cases. One is the case where we're keeping 32 supercharges in A plus 1 dimensions, and the other is the case where we're keeping 16 supercharges in A plus 1 dimensions. And remember, in 10 dimensions, the story that I had already was that I had the possibility of reducing of taking the type 2B theory, and I don't change the number of supercharges if I stick on a flat space such as a circle. So I have now S1 cross, I guess I'm doing the other way around, M1A cross S1. Or I could have started with 2A on M1A cross S1. Or I could have worked with M theory on M1A cross a 2 torus, T2. So these are three ways of arriving at 32 supercharged theories, and we've just decided that these two are equivalent by T-duality, and we had decided earlier that these two were, well, I'll call them S-dual. One was a strong coupling limit of the other. So all of these are together going to form a common space. And the question is, what does this space look like? Well, it's time for me to tell you something I should have told you quite a while ago, which is how we're going to measure the parameters for these compactified theories in more generality. I've been working up until this moment with the only cases where I compactified it was a circle, and I indicated one of the parameters was obviously going to be the size of the circle. But to get all the parameters, we have to pay attention to what the field content of these theories is. So in the case of M theory, there's a metric having to do with the gravity theory that we have in the story, and there's also a three-form field. And what that means in practice is that if you're compactifying M theory on some space and you're wanting to know what parameters there are in that space, you try to measure components of a symmetric two-form or a skew-symmetric three-form along that compactified space. So, for example, and I should say, of course, there are some equations of motion which define a kind of classical version of these theories, which, for example, would tell you that the three-form was harmonic. And this guy satisfied the Einstein equation. So you look for, just to get an idea of what the parameters are, if you're compactifying M theory, you look for metrics and harmonic three forms, metrics satisfying the Einstein equation and harmonic three forms with respect to those metrics, as the possible ways of labeling what happened to those fields along the compact part of the spacetime. And, well, in most of the situations, well, all the situations we're discussing today, those fields do not vary over the remaining part of the spacetime. Later we'll see some instances when you would like to consider cases in which some of these fields do vary. But at the moment, we won't let them vary. So in M theory, you get things like this. In the string theories, generally, you'll have a metric, and you'll have a two-form field, and you'll have this dilaton, and then in some cases you might get some other p-form fields in the so-called Ramon-Ramon sector for certain values of p, and then you can also get gauge fields in the heterotic and type 1 cases associated with those Yang-Mills theories. So I'll be a little bit more precise about what happens in the various theories when I need to quote them. For this one, for the moment, let me analyze it from the perspective of compactifying M theory on a 2 torus. So what I have to specify is a metric on the 2 torus, which satisfies the Einstein equation. So it's I don't know if this is a theorem, but we'll take it to be flat. Pardon? That's a theorem? Okay. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. There is none. Right. So I need a metric on T2, and I need... well, I need a three-form, but there aren't any three-forms on a two-torus. Aren't any harmonic three-forms on a two-torus. So that's the only thing that I'll use to describe the parameters. So how do I describe metrics on T2? Well, they're described by means of a conformal structure on T2. And the conformal structure is the same thing as a complex structure. And that's usually labeled by tau in the upper half plane, determined by tau in the upper half plane, although really, of course, as we know, the conformal structures live in the upper half plane mod SL2Z. So just from the point of view of labeling metrics, we have to mod out by SL2Z already there. We also have the area. So tau only specifies the metric up to a conformal rescaling, and so the area is the other parameter. Now, we've already seen essentially how to map from M theory to type 2A and to reinterpret this in type 2A. From the type 2A point of view, the interpretation was, well, I was going to need the size of the S1, which specifies the metric in type 2. I was going to need the value of the dilaton. And then I also have some kind of value of the Ramon-Ramon 1 form from the type 2A wrapped on the circle, integrated along the circle. So I get to choose some Ramon-Ramon 1 form. Those are the three coordinates. It's less natural to make all the identifications in terms of those three coordinates than it is in terms of the M-theory limit, which is why I chose to start there. But anyway, the parameter count is pretty clear, and you learn something from the exercise of, say, switching the roles of the two of a decomposition of T2 into S1 cross S1. You learn something interesting about the structure of the 2A theory that you wouldn't have expected just from the 2A theory. Namely, if you use this S1 as the one that compactifies from M to 2A, you get one description of the parameters in 2A. If you use the other one, you get another description of the parameters in 2A. But by using the duality in SL2Z, those two circles are playing basically equivalent roles. So there are unexpected identifications among parameters from the 2A perspective. Pardon?
The derivatives can be few.
That's what tau measures.
Yeah. When you think of limits, you seem to only look at the case like a rectangular
The angle is encoded in the value of this one form. More interesting for some purposes of mine later in the week is this case of 2B, the reinterpretation for 2B. So for 2B, remember, that's the case where we have actually two parameters in 10 dimensions. So in 10 dimensions, we have the dilaton and the Ramon-Ramon scalar. And then we also have in this compactification from 2B down to 9 dimensions, we also have the size of the S1, which I'll call L sub B, the length sub B. So where's my formula? Here we go. So so the identification between the parameters, which was worked out independently by Paul Aspinwall and John Schwartz, was that tau is related to exactly this combination, exactly this complex combination of the dilaton and the Ramon-Ramon scalar on which SL2Z acts. So in particular, this is compatible with the SL2Z action. The SL2Z action in the 2B side being the one from the S duality in 10 dimensions, and the SL2Z on the M theory side being the one that comes from essentially the structure of the torus, the ambiguity in labeling the torus. It's the connected components of the diffeomorphism group of the torus. The crucial one, which is that the area when raised to the minus 3/4 power is equal to the length on the B side. So the remaining parameter behaves precisely this way. And in particular, you see that the effect of making the area small for this compactification of M theory on T2. If A goes to zero, then the size of the S1 grows large again, and you get a decompactification. So one of the conclusions is that shrinking the area of T2 in these theories with N compactified on M1A cross T2 leads to an effective 9 plus 1 dimensional theory. You decompactify and get back to 2B in 10 dimensions precisely in this way. So so that's the picture. I have the possibility of describing, well, what can I do with in various limits? I can sort of decompactify one circle, decompactify it, having decompactified it, one of the circles, interpret what I've got as a 2A theory in 10 dimensions. If I decompactify both of the circles, I can interpret what I have as a 2A theory in as M theory in 11 dimensions. If I squeeze down the entire area, I end up getting another limit point, which is described as the 2B theory. And this actually exhausts all the possible limiting points that you can take in this moduli space if you look at it correctly. Right. When I shrink down the LB, of course, from the 2B perspective, according to the T-duality, I get myself with a large 2A theory again. So probably the best way to look at it is as a product of this thing with the LB and the H mod SL2Z, where you can see what all three limit points are, from going to two different size on the LB space or the limit point on the upper half plane. Yeah. Mod. Yeah. That's right. That's correct. It should be a product, yes. Because this is to be thought of as this should be a symmetric space for an E group of a very low number, very low kind, right? E1, I believe. E2. Well, E2 is very hard to define. E2 is not reductive. Yeah. Yeah, E3 is A1 times A2. E2 is not reductive. It's the automorphism group of this space, of the universal cover, if you like. Pardon? Well, it's not only not reductive, but it's also. Sorry, it's reductive, but it's not semi-simple. That's what I'm trying to say. It's reductive, but it's not semi-simple. So it has an abelian factor, which you can see there, a non-compact abelian factor, R plus, and then it's got an SL2 factor. And so I think the metric has to split as a product as a result of it. Well, to finish the discussion of 9 dimensions, I should discuss the theories with 16 supercharges in A plus 1 dimensions. And so what are the sources for these things? Well, remember I had the two heterotic theories. Which I've already said were related to each other by a T-duality, once I compactify them on a single circle. Then I had an S-duality, which related this theory to the type 1 theory. That happened already in 10 dimensions, but if I formulate things on S1 cross M1A, if I formulate things on these spaces that include a circle, that same duality should hold. And then I had a T-duality here to the type 1 prime theory, which was formulated on S1 cross S1 mod Z2 cross M1A. And on the other hand, I had an S-duality here to between HE in 10 dimensions, between HE and M theory on S1 mod Z2. And now I should extend that to this case where I've got this additional circle in the space. So the claim is going to be that these guys are exactly the same. In fact, from the description that we were giving, well, you can treat this from several different points of view, but from the description we were giving, we had something that looked like 2A theory, but with some additional open strings and places that it had to go on the boundary and things of that sort. And that's exactly what you would expect to see here in this M theory formulated on these, Harjava-Witten construction of this M theory formulated on this S1 mod Z2. I neglected to mention that, of course, these guys can serve as endpoints for open strings, which are now allowed to exist in this theory as well. So, so this is really an equivalent way of describing this guy, this one prime that I mentioned here. There's a subtlety having to do with what happens to those 16 D8 brains, but I'm running out of time, so I'm not going to say too much about that today. Let me focus just briefly on the interpretation of this result, which is very pretty from the point of view of the parameter spaces. So what is it that I need to specify for a heterotic theory? Well, as I mentioned, in these cases of string theories, the basic things are a metric, a two-form field, the dilaton, and then in the case of the heterotic theory, some gauge fields, which if I'm partially compactifying, I should describe as some kind of connection with values in that gauge algebra living on the S1. So in algebraic geometry, that becomes some kind of, well, not algebraic geometry for S1, but in geometry, that becomes some kind of bundle associated to a structure group of type EA cross E8 or spin 32 mod Z2 in these two cases. Later, we'll discuss compactifying the heterotic string on tori of higher dimensions, and in the case of T2, we'll actually end up wanting to say what those bundles are, what those bundles mean in algebraic geometry. But for now, for S1, we can basically measure the bundle, well, by studying, say, a Cartan subalgebra of either of these guys, which are rank 16 subalgebras, and asking what the holonomy on that connection is as you go around this particular S1. So I look at a Cartan subalgebra U1 to the 16, which is sitting inside of my E8 cross E8, say on the left-hand side of this picture, and I measure the holonomy of this abelian bundle as I go around this S1, and I get 16 numbers. I get essentially a C star to the 16, a U1, well, rats. I get a U1 to the 16, which measures the bundle along S1. Pardon? Thank you. Mazel Levi group. And let me just say WE. And I also had the size of the S1, which was some, again, R plus, and then I had my other R plus, which was the dilaton. So this is the basic picture that you have. Now, this turns out to be precisely the space 01, 17 mod 01 cross 017 mod on the left by an integral parabolic subgroup associated to this E. So I've got some inclusion of the E8 plus E8 lattice inside an integral unimodular lattice of signature 1, 17, integral even unimodular lattice of signature 1, 17, and corresponding to that embedding, there's some integral parabolic subgroup, and that's what this space is. It turns out that the entire parameter space, once you've analyzed all of the dualities properly, is actually this space modded out by the full O117 with coefficients in Z. So what we're seeing is the natural description near one of the boundaries of that space. That's the sort of thing you would expect to see if you're trying to build compactifications of locally symmetric spaces of that kind, that you need to restrict your attention to the parabolic identifications from an integer parabolic subgroup, which are exactly the ones that are relevant near the boundary point, and then you split up the space something like this, and you analyze it from that perspective. If you look at the HO space, you end up with an O117 mod O1 cross O17 mod a different integer parabolic associated with, well, it's the root lattice of spin 32 mod Z2, which is another rank 16 definite even unimodular lattice, which also sits in lambda 117. Those are, up to conjugacy, the only two possible rank 16 definite unimodular lattices. And in fact, this space, O117 mod O1 cross O17 mod the entire orthogonal group of this lattice, has precisely two ends associated to these two parabolics, which are unique up to conjugacy, associated to POZ and PEZ, respectively. So it's a much larger space. It's a 17-dimensional, I forgot the R plus. This R plus doesn't play a role. That's the dilaton. This is the weak coupling description. Yes. Yeah. Unimodular and even, that makes this unique. And then there are two unimodular even definite lattices of rank 16, and they both embed. Each embedding is unique, and those are the two possible parabolics that give you these two ends. So the picture, although the dimension is much larger, is sort of similar, that there are just two places to go. There's also this other R plus direction. But at weak coupling, there are two places to go, and you get precisely these two different string theories when you do that. When you go to strong coupling now, you see that the same picture is reproduced, except it's now the picture between the type 1 on the one hand, or the type 1 prime, which can be interpreted in M-theoretic terms on some kind of cylinder instead of torus from this perspective. So the overall picture of the moduli space kind of fits together that way for the situation of 16 supercharges. Okay, well, I think that's probably my time.